Okay, so the topic may seem like ancient history to those who can remember, but like in 2009, the Tevatron measured the DT-bar asymmetry, which was way off the standard model prediction, and it created lots of excitement. Since then, of course, lots of time passed, and the standard model prediction got improved, and the DT-bar asymmetry went lower. So there's not such an exciting discrepancy anymore, but there's still kind of a mismatch between the two. So if you just take the viewpoint that there is maybe at least a new physics contribution, then we can ask the question, can we build a model which explains this? And this is actually not so easy to build a model which explains a relatively large DT-bar asymmetry and is at the same time consistent with all kinds of other constraints from collider observables or flavor physics. And what I will show you today is a model which we developed which involves new strong interactions and a whole bunch of new resonances, which are have masses of the order of 200 GeV and generate the DT-bar symmetry via T-channel exchange. So it's in the class of the T-channel models. And I think it's quite, like, even if you say, oh, the DT-bar symmetry is probably just a measurement issue or it's consistent with the standard model, I think it's still interesting to see that we can have a new strong interactions, which we can hide very well at the LHC, which have a relatively low scale, and still it can produce a measurable or a large DT-bar asymmetry. Ah, I should have this.
Yeah. Oh, well, if you want to use the traditional Canadian point.
I use the traditional Canadian point. Exactly.
You're also welcome.
Yeah, I can use it for flipping the slides. Okay. Well, here's the plan for the talk. So I'll quickly summarize the situation of the DT-bar asymmetry. Then I talk about flavor symmetric scenarios, which helps us to avoid mainly constraints from flavor physics and also from collider physics. And then I go to a concrete realization of such a scenario, which is our strong interaction model. And then I show you some results of our model, our benchmark. Okay, so the Tevatron collided protons and antiprotons, and it produces top antitop pairs, and it measured an asymmetry. So it measures that the top quark is preferentially produced in the direction of the incoming proton, and the antitop quark is preferentially produced in the direction of the incoming antiproton. And this asymmetry arises already in the standard model at next leading order QCD by some combination of color factors which are odd under charge conjugation. So this is already a standard model effect. So the forward backward asymmetry is just defined as the number of top quarks which go in the forward direction and the minus the number of antitops which the tops which go in the backward direction, and it's measured to be 12.3%. And here, okay, this is it's an naive average which we did between the CDF result and the new D0 update. Okay. But in the following, we will just try to reproduce the CDF result, which is larger than the D0 result, just as a kind of as a question of principle, can we have these new strong interactions and produce a large DT-bar asymmetry? Of course, we can then also tune the parameters and get a smaller asymmetry. That's no problem. It has been predicted in the standard model. This is the standard model prediction. It includes not only the QCD effects, it includes also electric corrections and resummed logs. And you see that, like, the naive average is now about 1.5 sigma away. So it's up to your taste if you want to call this a discrepancy or a nice agreement. Another thing which at least CDF observed is the rise of the asymmetry in bins of the invariant DT-bar mass. This is also not really confirmed by the D0 result, but like they also use a different binding, so it's always a bit difficult to compare. But okay, in the future, we will, for the rest of the talk, we'll just concentrate on the CDF result. At the LHC, you cannot really measure the forward-backward asymmetry because the initial state is symmetric. It collides only protons. But you can use the fact that the up quark in the proton is a valence quark, whereas the anti-up quark in the proton is a C quark. So it turns out that the top quarks are more preferentially produced in the beam direction, and the anti-top quarks are more preferentially produced in the central detection of the detector. So you can define a corresponding charge asymmetry, as I call it, at the LHC, and it has also been measured by Atlas and CMS at 7 and 8 TeV, and it's of the order of 1%. It's much smaller than the forward-backward asymmetry because at the LHC the gluon contribution, which is completely symmetric, dominates, and it's also consistent with the standard model prediction. It has still quite large errors. Okay, so if you do a general analysis, has been done by Greenstein et al., you see that in order to explain the forward-backward asymmetry, so they did a fit of the cross-sections and their symmetries, that you need interference between some new physics and standard model states. And there are some favorite scenarios. You can have S-channel exchange of new particles, like a color octet vector with axial couplings, which then produces the forward-backward asymmetry like the mu plus mu minus asymmetry is produced at lab by the set boson. Or you can exchange a T-channel particle, a color singlet or colored resonances, and then you produce the TT bar asymmetry via the Rutherford peak of the T-channel propagator, so it has this angle dependence. And this actually allows also easily to explain the rise of the asymmetry with increasing TT bar invariant mass. And again, if you just write down a general model with just a general T-channel vector, then it turns out if you have a T-channel with a mass of a few hundred GeV, it can yield a large forward-backward asymmetry, which rises with the invariant mass. And at the same time, it's in good agreement with the measured spectrum, like the TT bar differential spectrum. It's easier for the T channel than for the S channel. For the S channel, it's easy to find a bump in the spectrum. Of course, if you just write down a completely general T channel model, there are lots of problems. You have to make sure that the total and the differential cross sections are not modified because they agree well with the prediction. You can have same sign top production or single top production. And also, in order to create the forward-backward asymmetry in the T-channel, you need large couplings between the up quark and the top quark. So you might, in general, be worried about FCNCs, for example, D0, D0 bar mixing. Also, if you have this the C prime, which covers to up and top, then you can produce the following state. You can, with a gluon and a quark initial state, you can produce a top, which radiates off a C primed, which then decays into anti-top and a quark. So this also gives a contribution to the inclusive TT bar cross section. And this is also like the top and jet resonance surges are sensitive to this particle. So you need somehow a suppressed branching ratio. You need another branching ratio, like the C prime cannot only decay into up and top, otherwise you are excluded already. So in our model, actually this will be a composite particle, a resonance like the rho, and it will decay into other particles like pions. So we have naturally another decay channel. Yeah, pions, I'll explain about what, yeah. Not the QCD pions. On the other hand, this associated production is important. We need it because, okay, in general, the forward-backward symmetry and the charge asymmetry at Teveton and LHC, they are correlated. They are so it's the same basic physics. So if you have a large AFP, you expect a large charge asymmetry. But there's a kinematic effect which breaks this correlation, which is exactly this this associated production of the C primed. And so here you use the fact that the U quark, which is a valence quark, prefers to have a higher momentum than the gluon from the proton. And so it goes into a C primed and then decays into a T bar. So now the T bar prefers to be produced in the beam direction. And this is exactly the opposite of what happens from the pure TT bar production. So this breaks the correlation between AFB and the charge asymmetry. So in order to be consistent, with other constraints, we need a branching ratio of order 25%. Okay, and as I mentioned, in our case, the C prime will be like a K star resonance which decays. There's something wrong here. There should be a K and a pi, but it's a resonance, and we have a natural other decay mode. Okay, so in general, to be safe from flavor constraints, we look at models which have global symmetry, like which are invariant under this U3 Q left times U3 U right times U3 down right, which you reckon, yes?
Maybe something on the last line. So, can you explain again the business of breaking the correlation? I mean, I understand what this diagram does, but are you saying that therefore you expect to see less of it than NHC? Well, why do you need why do you need to break the correlation?
Exactly, because in like if it would it okay. At the, let's assume we have a large asymmetry at the Tevatron. Let's only look at the CDF data. So we have a large forward backward asymmetry. So you would expect also a large charge asymmetry at the LHC.
But what are you assuming is the cause for the forward backward asymmetry when you say that? When you say that you assume that if you have a forward backward asymmetry, you also expect large charge asymmetry.
Well, the standard model plus the new physics contribution.
So it's particularly, you're saying for particular kind of new physics.
Right, let's say in our.
In forward backward, there is generally also contribution in charge.
Right, like in our T channel model, we would also have a larger charge asymmetry.
Okay, and so we're saying in this particular kind of new physics, you actually don't expect large charge.
Exactly, because we have this additional contribution, right? Okay, because we have two contributions. We have the T-channel exchange of this vector, and then we have the associated production of this vector.
And can you account for this factor? You account for interference effects as well? Or are you just taking the square of this and the square of the other one?
That the whole thing is in the interference effect?
No, not in the new physics. New physics is just a square of the T-channel.
Yeah, because it's a different state, right? Because here we have this the up quark.
So here are you dominated by interference of this with the TT bar plus up standard model, or are you dominated by this new physics squared?
No, by the new physics squared.
I
should check, but I think
it's not a big deal. But I just wondering because you have now two contributions from new physics, and I'm just wondering how you calculate the new physics. But it's not a big deal. You can talk about it.
Contribution is interference, right?
No, the first contribution. First contribution is just Z prime exchange,
which gives a correction to the standard model amplitude, right? So it's then the report.
The signal is
an interference between the standard model
and the new physics.
UU going to GT, right? Plus there is a square of that. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. And how do they cancel against each other? This the first interference term and this.
So they tend to have the opposite effect. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so to be safe, so if we generally construct this model to be safe with respect to flavor observables and also same sign top production, etc., we look at models which are invariant under this symmetry group, which is of course the flavor symmetry of the standard model. If you neglect the Yukawa couplings, or because you know the top Yukawa coupling is large already, you can also just look at the subgroup where you only have the flavor symmetry in the light two generations, and then you can show that if you have a model which does not constrain breaking of the symmetry group beyond the standard model Yukawa, so you're in a minimal flavor violating context here, which contains new fields in non-trivial representations of these symmetry groups, and which have large couplings to the top and the light quarks, then you can avoid all these constraints like sign or single top production, flavor changing neutral currents, DD bar mixing, and so on, and still get a sufficiently large forward backward symmetry. So a simple possibility which tends to work very well is just to look at the U3 U-right flavor octet vectors, which couple only to the right-handed up quarks. So you can have T-channel couplings, which in our case will be, for example, a K-star, something like a K-star. You can have S-channel exchange, which in our case would be like a phi or omega in QCD. So this will become clearer later what this means. So now if you have massive vectors, then of course these models are not renormalizable, and they have basically two options for UV completion. So they could either be the Goldstone bosons of a spontaneously broken flavor gauge symmetry, or these vector mesons could be composite. And it turns out if you try to write down a model with a gauged flavor symmetry, then you usually end up with a very complicated Higgs sector, and it's usually fine-tuned. It's not so easy to write down a nice model. So we try the other direction. We write down a model where these vector resonances are actually composite.
It's anomaly free, the single gauging.
Which one?
Whatever you're gauging, you made sure it's anomaly free, or are you just setting it?
Yes, it's a, yeah. You'll see, I think, in the next slide what we do. Okay, so what we do is we postulate a new SU3 hypercolor gauge interaction. And why SU3? Okay, it's a strong interaction, and we don't really know how to compute anything strongly interacting, really. So we just want to model everything from QCD. So basically, what we really do is we take QCD and we use our knowledge and scale everything up to a high scale. Okay. We call it hypercolor because it has nothing to do with electric symmetry breaking. So this is why we call it a hypercolor. But of course, it's kind of similar.
But wasn't the original, or one of the original proposals for Technicolor called hypercolor?
Maybe.
I thought there were two rival groups, and one of them called the Technicolor, and the other one called the hypercolor. Sorry.
Right. Okay, so we use QCD as a prototype, scale everything up to the new scale, and the scale is just given by this general analysis of the TT bar symmetry for T-channel vectors. So it's given is about 200 GeV. So then we add new particles. So we add the flavored triplet of standard model singlet hypercolor quarks, a vector-like hypercolor quarks. Okay, so there should be no anomalies. And then also we add a flavor singlet scalar S, which turns out to be a color triplet. Okay, so here are the quantum numbers. So under the extended gauge symmetry of the standard model plus the hypercolor, the hypercolor quarks are triplets and otherwise complete standard model singlets. And the scalar is a hypercolor anti-triplet. It has a color charge, it's a triplet, and it has hypercharge, 2/3. Okay, and these quantum numbers are, I say that late. These quantum numbers are chosen in such a way that we can write down a Yukawa coupling between the right-handed standard model quark, the new hypercolor quark, and the scalar. So these new particles talk to the right-handed uptype quarks just because of our assignment of the gauge couplings, gauge charges. Okay, so the we can diagonalize the Yukawa interactions, and we take them of the form so that the light two generations are degenerate, and also that the same for the masses, and we take also the masses of the first two generations of hyperquarks much smaller than the third generation, and both of them much smaller than the confinement scale. So this is really like the up down and strange in QCD. So if you want to think, like, if you want to make the translation between our hypercolor model and QCD, you think of this assignment like up down strange is equivalent to Q up, Q charm, and Q top. Okay, so that's our flavor symmetry. So now we have these new hypercolor quarks, and they are strongly interacting. So like in QCD, they will form resonances. So we will have a no-net of vector resonances like in QCD. So we call it rho hypercolor, K star hypercolor, phi hypercolor, omega hypercolor. And we will also have the excited resonances, of course, like the axial vector resonances, the A1, K1A, and so on. And just for simplicity, because there's, of course, a huge amount of resonances, we just neglect all the other resonances. Look at these. Yes?
What happens to your
scalar,
to S?
I'll come to that.
Okay. It doesn't condense or anything.
It turns out it doesn't condense because it's like the top, it decays too fast. But in principle, it would also form bound states. Okay, I'll explain this, and this will also involve a little bit of hand waving. Okay, but first of all, you have these resonances, and then exactly as in QCD, the kinetic term of our Lagrangian has a chiral symmetry, SU3 left cross SU3 right. So exactly as in QCD, we expect there to be spontaneous symmetry breaking and an octet of pseudo Nambu-Goldstone bosons. So we also have a pion and a kaon and an eta hypercolor. And just also for simplicity, and because it doesn't really contribute to the phenomenology, we neglect the singlet eta prime. And then, as I mentioned already, we just scale everything up from QCD. So we use naive scaling relations. So we scale all the decay constant and masses up to QCD. And we use also the ratio of the rho decay constant to rho mass as in QCD. So then the scale of the new interaction is given by as 200 GeV approximately from this general analysis. From this, we can compute the by the scaling relations, we can compute the value of the pion decay constant, and then using the usual formula which relates the yes.
I don't agree about the massless pions or the pseudo goldstones, because you now have an additional source of breaking of the SU3 plus SU3, which is the coupling with the scalar. Your masses are not the only thing that breaks SU3 left plus SU3 right. But if I understood you correctly, you also have a coupling in the Lagrangian, which is the star model field times S times the new fields. that also breaks this left right.
But if it couples only one chirality of this quark, does it couple to both chiralities? Could you show the Lagrangian in S?
Right, it couples only to the
Right handed.
Yes.
Or to left handed only. So it might be okay. Because it couples to only one chirality. So it does not mediate chirality flip.
But it still breaks the separate S just left. You don't your group before condensation is not S just left, but S just right. It's more like some U1 left, because you can rotate S times SU2 right. So times whatever S just left. I don't know how much it matters for your model, because you can set H small and then it's a small effect. But if you are gonna rely on those pions to be very light, you might wanna check that.
All right. I'm sure we must have thought about this. I just cannot recall at the moment. Somehow I remember it didn't affect the, or we convinced ourselves that doesn't affect the pattern of the breaking.
How likely those gold cones to be for your model?
Well, there will be about between 60 and 100 GV, or around 100 GV. So just from using the scaling relations and this relation between the squared pion masses and the quark masses. So it depends on what masses we assign to the quarks, but if you take them of order 10 GeV, then they will be of order 100 GeV.
It's fine. Not necessarily the mass, so it's good.
Okay, and then if we use vector mass and dominance arguments to approximate the rho pi pi coupling, then we find that also the resonances have like the rho to pi pi has a width of about 10%. I'll think about this. Probably I'm just confused now, but I'm sure we have thought about this. Maybe I'll remember later. Okay, so in principle, you're right. We could also have bound states of the scalars. Like we could have a bound state of two scalars, and because they are color triplets, this would be a color octet or color signet. And we could also have bound states of a scalar and a quark. But it turns out that the partonic width of the S in our benchmark model for our benchmark parameters. Is much larger than the hadronic scale which governs the hadronization. So like the top quark, it will decay before it can form any bound state. And this is partially related to the fact that we have to make the S very, very heavy. And this, again, the problem is if we make this light, if we make the scalar light, it could form a bound state. And then this bound state, which can be exchanged in the S channel, would appear as a huge bump in the differential deep R spectrum. So we are forced to make it very heavy. So we have to make it heavy so it doesn't affect the differential spectrum.
By the way, I think the interaction has violated symmetry because the Q fields are in the adjoint. So the transform and the product of the left and the right. So I think the interaction was symmetric. It was U, Q, and the scalar. And U bar gives you an adjoint, then Q would transform as a left-hand matrix, and then on the left and on the right. Understand what I'm saying? No.
Principally, let that continue, and we can adjust it later.
Yes.
So how heavy is your MS? So the width is 230 and MS is like a TV?
Yeah, it's like half a TV.
Oh,
half a TV. Okay. So in, again, now comes a little bit of hand waving because we're just trying to understand how this really works. But so now we have all these resonances, which are complete standard model singlets, okay? But somehow, of course, we need to couple to the standard model in order to get the TT bar symmetry, okay? And so how does this work? So because of so these fields, the new quarks and the scalar, they mix with the right-handed quarks via these Yukawa couplings. Okay, and then okay, let's so if we look at this, so this is what happens, okay? The up mixes via the Yukawa coupling into the S and the and this hypercolor quark, okay? It forms the resonance in the T channel and okay, and it mixes back into the T and T, and the same for the anti up and the anti top, okay? And so in order to compute this mixing, we assume that these bound sets are really formed, okay? Because we have to compute an effective mixing between the U's and the U primes, which are bound sets of the S and the hyperquark, which with exactly the same quantum numbers as the standard model U quark. And what we are saying is that if you think of this as a real diagram with a propagator, then like the effective width, which appears here in the propagator, is not really the platonic width or the width which we computed, but it depends on the virtuality, and it's small for small virtualities. So we think that this is at least a good approximation for computing the mixing, because we somehow now need to couple these resonances to the standard model quarks. So if you just assume this, okay, for the following, this is a good approximation, then we just write down the mass matrix for the U quarks and the U primed quarks, and we diagonalize it, and we get mixing angles between the flavor eigenstates and the mass eigenstates. And we get corresponding mixing angles for the right-handed quarks and also for the left-handed quarks, which are in addition suppressed by the quark masses. So this will be non-zero only for the left-handed top. Okay. Then we write down the coupling of these resonances to these fermions, like in this. Okay, this is all just like an effective Lagrangian for QCD for the row resonances. And we estimate this coupling again via vector Mason dominance, and then we diagonalize and we get the coupling of these resonances to the standard model quarks from mixing. So in order to get order one couplings between the up and the top quark, we need Yukawa couplings of the order of two, and the mixing, the sign of the mixing angles will be between 0.2 and 0.4. Okay. So, but remember the main decay channel of the row is really, really into pions. Okay. And correspondingly, the main decay channel of the K star is into K's and pi's. But in this case, because we need 25% branching ratio into up and top, we adjust the masses of the K and pi so that we suppress this decay channel, so in order to get the 25% branching ratio into quarks by tuning the phase space. But it's actually not a very large tuning which we need.
Sorry, hold on. Your S-cube is essentially a new fermion, right, in the low energy theory.
Yes.
And that fermion has a mass of, like, your QCD, hyper-QCD, right?
Well, in this case, if it were really allowed to form, it would be very heavy. It would be about 700 GeV.
Right, but then you have, if you think about the low energy Lagrangian, you have the D quarks, for example, have a mass from the Higgs, there is also a mixing with this heavy state, and the heavy state itself has a heavy mass. That means that if you diagonalize it, your big quark should be a lot, much smaller in mass than the Higgs contribution. You essentially have a cis-type mechanism.
But you're talking about the standard model weak quark?
Yeah.
No, but
you're mixing with it.
No, we mix only with the right-handed up quarks.
Ah,
yeah.
It's not affecting the mass.
Yeah, sorry.
Mm-hmm. But you are right that, I mean, if I understood you correctly, I mean, there will be a contribution. So now the top will get its mass not only from the Yukawa coupling, but also from this mixing effect. This is correct. And we computed this, and it's about, we computed the corresponding shift in the Yukawa coupling. It's about 1%. So it's very small, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So it's below sensitivity.
Is there a Z rho HC mixing at the loop formula? It's a loop
problem. Okay.
There could be. So we checked some of the electroweak observables, and the ones we checked, either it vanishes or the effect is very small. I don't know if it checks this.
If there is a mixing, right, between the Z and this rho, right, and there can be extra contributions to forward, backwards, left, right asymmetries, things like that.
No, this we didn't check.
It's one of them.
Okay. Okay, so for the pions, we do the same thing. We write down an effective interaction like the pion nuclear coupling in QCD, and then we get the coupling of the pions to the standard model quarks again, just from the mixing. And since the pion is the lightest of these hypercolor particles, it will via this interaction, it will decay into dead pairs. So pairs of light quarks. Maybe quickly, because I'm kind of running out of time. So in QCD, we have this adjoint and singlet state of the up and downs, which are given here, like this, the singlet and this adjoint. And what happens in QCD is that these two mix in such a way that the omega has almost only the up and the down quarks, and the phi is almost only an SS bar bound state, and this is called ideal mixing. And this is important to understand this, because if this happens in our case, then there will be no S channel contribution from the exchange of these resonances, because then one of them will have only, or no S channel contribution to TT bar asymmetry and production, because then one of them will have only charm and up quantum numbers, and the other only top. So you cannot produce a TT bar from the proton. So in order to compute this, we use a naive. So we follow this publication, and we use a very naive quark model fit. So they wrote down a model for QCD and for the QCD resonances in terms of quarks. So they took a general number L of light quarks and one heavier quark. So if you take L equals 2, then this is just, again, QCD with up and down, which are much smaller than the strange mass. Yes, right. Okay, and then, so we take this model. What we do is we fit these expressions, so the expressions for the masses and for the mixing angles, to the observed QCD spectrum. So we get all these expressions in dependence on the quark masses, and then we scale everything up to QCD, and then we get the same expressions again in dependence of the quark mass, and then we can just adjust our quark mass And we have the feeling that in this way, we have something which is kind of reasonable because it basically comes from QCD. So in, other than just like inventing these mixing angles, okay. So this is the setup, and now we want to compare with data. So we need to find a good benchmark. And let me stress that okay, we have this relatively large amount of resonances and couplings and so on. But really, we didn't add much to the standard model. We just added the triplet of vector-like quarks and the scalar and the Yukawa couplings. Okay, so we really have not very much free parameters. And in order to find a good benchmark, what we did, we wrote down a chi-squared. We minimized the chi-squared, which included the inclusive and the high bin and the low bin Tevatron AFP, the charge asymmetry at LHC 7TeV, and the inclusive LHC and Tevatron TD bar cross section, just in order to get an idea what our parameters should look like. And then we fit for our UV parameters, which is just the scale of the new interactions, the masses of the hypercolor quarks and the scalar, and the Yukawa couplings.
And you also contribute to Z to DB bar for left right. Right, because the Z can go to your heavy guys, the one loop.
All right, but then you still need to couple to the B quarks, so I guess this would be heavily suppressed.
Also, there's a correction to
parity.
Parity observables, because your vector coupling of up quark will be affected, right? The up quark can split into top and whatever your new resonance, right? And that gives one loop correction to the vertex, but it's going to be poor time because it's not.
And this we actually checked, like for the atomic parity violation, we did a kind of estimate of the diagrams, and it's borderline. I think it's like the change is small. You're not excluded from
there
it.
There was a recent measurement by Uwick of the same quantities, the weak charge. Vector charge, probably not enough.
Yeah, we're not
exclude one loop correction.
Yeah. Okay. This is what comes out of the fit. So our scale is given by 171 GeV. We have light quarks of 3 GeV and a heavy quark of like 30.5 GeV. Our scalar is 520 GeV, and Yukawa couplings are at 2 and 4.4, plus we have some fudge factors of order 1 because we allow for small deviations from the exact scaling from QCD. Okay, and this results, for example, in the following spectrum. So our pi will have a mass of about 62 GeV, the kaon, so these are all the hypercolor particles, will have 143, so it's a bit lighter than the top quark. The eta is about 161 GeV, and then we have the vector resonances, so they are all around 200 GeV. And then we also get the axial vector resonances, which I didn't put here in the table, but they're just between 2 and 300 GeV.
So this lightest particles from this sector, they decay back to the Stern model?
Right, exactly. So the pions, they decay into two jets.
And quick prompt?
Yes. Okay, so here's the forward backward asymmetry. So first the inclusive asymmetry with, agrees nicely with the CTF measurement, and you see also that we can nicely explain the rise in the TT bar invariant mass, and there's also a measurement by CTF in the absolute in bins of absolute rapidity difference, which where they also saw a rise. So we can also explain this rise. Okay. Then for the charge symmetry at LHC, Again, just to remind you that here's the measurement, which is of the order of 1% with large errors, and the standard and agrees with the standard model prediction. So if we take our benchmark without this, if we switch off this associated production of the K star resonance, we are above this this measurement. So we are about 2.5%. But if we switch on this effect, then we are back to about 1%. So this is a nice effect and it looks pretty good. Then we checked also the inclusive cross sections and the differential cross sections. And as you can see at CDF, at Atlas and CMS, it looks quite nice. Okay, the CDF cross section at the peak comes out a bit low. So you see it's 6.8 and the measured value is 7.5. But also remember this, the standard model prediction is also around 7. So the measured cross section is a bit on the high side anyway. So I think it looks pretty good. Okay. So this was for the TT bar observers. So there are also lots of other constraints from colliders which we have to check. So for example, the exchange of the resonances which don't have the top flavor, they can, for example, contribute to the digit spectra. So we can have a T channel, S channel, and T channel exchange of these resonances. They contribute to digit production. And okay, we checked this. And we compared with like our model and the standard model predictions for the Tevatron and for LHC, and you see it. You see no deviation from between our model and the standard model. Another observable is digit angular correlations, and so here the observables is the same exponent of the rapidity difference of the two jets. And you again, we compare standard model and new physics, and you see it. So this is standard model and standard model plus new physics. And you see it's it agrees like really very nice with each other. So there's no deviation in digits. No, we haven't looked at this.
There is a constraint that you can get from earlier 80s measurements of the W and Z peaks. I mean, the backgrounds are not easily calculated, and they mostly just it fits the backgrounds, but they definitely saw the W and Z digit peak.
Okay, yeah, this is a good point. This maybe you should check. I should look at. Mm-hmm. No, we didn't do this.
Can I ask a question? Mm-hmm. So the data seems to a systematic deviation from standard model at low on the left of the plots on the right.
Yes.
Make it that all of the plots on the right and on the very left.
Mm-hmm.
On the right hand side.
Yeah.
But all of the left data points, you could go to the left of each plot.
Yeah.
You know, there's a systematic discrepancy. Should I make anything of that?
Okay. So we didn't really compare with the data. I think what we show the data here, but we compared only our model to the standard model.
Yes,
so I think
if
I don't know.
If you see it on the left and not on the right, that's bad because they're just alternating masses. But that's a sign that your eye's misleading you. But I think I kind of see it on the right too.
Like the deviation in the low winds, yes.
Yeah.
On both sides, but on the right hand side of the sky.
Low side, low
and
chi.
Low chi.
So low chi, I guess, means is more symmetric, right?
Yeah, Yeah, it's something like 1 minus cosine theta of over 1 plus cosine theta, yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, sorry, but I didn't really look at the data points here. Okay, another constraint comes from a CDF search, which searches for dijet pairs, which come from a production of a resonance, which then decays into two other resonances, and then each decays into a pair of dijets. So there's a bound for in terms of the masses of the x and the y, and like what is relevant for us, so our x would be the rho and the y would be the pi. So we are somewhere in this row here where okay our row is 177 and the pi is just in between here, so it's below 100, it's between like 70 and 110 GeV somewhere, and we computed this the cross section and so we are below this bound, so our cross section is at 35 picobound. Okay, then top jet resonance searches, which come from this, so we can get the contribution from this diagram with the associate production of the K star. Again, there are searches from CDF and from Atlas, and if you just compare the production cross section times the branching ratio into top jet for the two cases, you see that in both cases we are about an order of magnitude below the bound from the searches. And if you look at the contributions from the higher resonances like the axial vector, then we are even much lower. Okay, then we can not only produce the K star in association with the top, but also the K. And recall that the kaon mass is a bit below the top mass, so it cannot decay into an on-shell top, so it goes into an off-shell top. And there could be, like if you miss the jet, for example, so there could be contributions to the single top plus W production, and also to the it could contribute to the TT bar inclusive cross section. And we also, so we took, for example, these two analyses from CMS, and we implemented their cuts, and then we saw like how large is our contribution from this diagram, and then it's in both cases it's smaller than the current experimental error. Then, okay, so what about direct production of our new resonances? So this is so in general, what will happen is that, so for example, if we look at these SS star productions, so this will decay into these hypercolor quarks, and they will all like hadronize in a complicated way, which we don't know, but we don't know exactly how to compute this, but we expect that just by looking at the invariant masses of these production cross sections, we have enough phase space for multiple production of hypercolor pions and kaons. So we really, what we expect is like an exotic multi-jet final state. And this is not very well constrained by current searches. So one analysis which comes kind of close is this is this analysis. So they looked for 6-jet and 10-jet final states. And in particular, they didn't look for any resonances. So they just looked for this final states, and they interpreted it in terms of an R parity violating decay of gluinos. And okay, we cannot really directly translate this also because our S is very broad, so we don't really know which mass it has. But if we just compute the partonic cross sections here, then we see that we are in all of these cases below the bound which they give in this mass range. Okay, so you see the bound for the, if they have no B jet, it's like it's about 2 picobarn, and we are like below 1 picobarn. Okay, so I think we are for the moment safe here. Okay, and then we checked some of the electric precision data. So one, so this atomic parity violation, which we discussed already a little bit, it was advocated as like really a constraint which kills all T-channel models, and we this is not the, so in our case we are not killed by it. So we estimated the effect on atomic parity violation by computing these diagrams. Okay, and we find sub per mil effects on these effective couplings, and they are consistent with the current measurements. Okay.
Can you have Z going to offshore Z going to this pi HC contribute? I mean some effective process like that.
Okay.
You have okay, 65 MeV in your states.
Right?
Okay.
GV.
So the C.
So there is at least.
Okay.
I mean, there's a possibility of producing them at least by mass at the lab too, right? And which will be then the clean signature of 4Gs, right?
Okay. So, okay. The set, of course, it doesn't couple to the the pans directly. So it
not
must.
Not directly. No.
So. You would have to go to a quark and then mix into this would be hypercolor quark, which then decays.
But this right. So
but
there can be a charge reduced kind of effective thing to this pi HC, right? I mean, there's some mixture of quarks and everything at some level there, right? So maybe it's not enough cross section.
Because fundamentally, your Z does couple to your heavy quarks.
To the heavy quarks, yes.
Right, there's a hypercharge coupling. So there should be some charge radius kind of operator.
Charge radius operator, most likely. Which, will be saturated by the energy of lab 2, so it's
not awesome. Not surprising.
Right, so it's something to look, right? Because then you get 4 jets, you take it, right?
All right. So I guess, just for, maybe it's a stupid, but a practical answer to this is that at the moment, we are also not focusing at like really taking every possible analysis which can constrain this model, because we will never finish to do this, because since 2 years, we are checking things. So what we did now, I think, is we kind of convinced ourselves that this, I mean, also these parameters, you can always tune them and play around with them, and I'm sure you will evade any constraint which we find by just playing with the parameters. But I think the main point maybe is that in principle you can have this model which you can very well hide from collider and precision constraints and have a large effect in FP. I think this is maybe before we get swamped in all these details.
But I disagree with that, because the constraints from the Z pole are very strong. And if you look at 4-jet events, or if you look at, for example, the constraint from the hadronic width of the Z, which is related, I mean, there you're getting the best extraction of alpha S at MZ. And I mean, you're adding in states that will contribute to that. I mean, that diagram right there contributes to it.
And then maybe we should look at this. Okay, so last slide already. So if we can hide it very well, okay, we have to look also at this C observables, it seems. But how could we find this model? Okay, one way to look at this is to look at these T-jet resonances, maybe also at LHC 13. Of course, there will be much more background, and it's not clear if this will show up in these resonances, but this is one way to look at. And also at the resonances for the K, where you have an off-shell top, and maybe you can improve the analysis by looking not really by not searching for an decaying on-shell top, but also like looking for an off-shell top which decays, like we have. For example, a softer lepton, so we can maybe change the cuts and get more sensitive. I think for these diejet pair constraints, the LHC will probably not be get more sensitive to this, but you could produce two rows which decay then into four pions, and so this goes via a U quark in the U channel. So you would produce two very forward row resonances which each decay into two pions, and each of the pions decays into a, either a fat jet, or if you can resolve it into two jets. So maybe this would be something you can look for. Okay. And also, so our model, of course, as any good new physics model, has a dark matter candidate, which is the it's a baryon, which is formed from the hypercolor quarks. It's stable because the model has an accidental C2 symmetry where all the new particles are odd. And it's interesting, it turns out that the relic density is tiny because the baryons, they just decay into the pions in the early universe. So it gives only like 10⁻⁸ times the observed dark matter density. But on the other hand, it has, if we make a very...
That a little bit surprises me. Why that smaller number? Because this is all electroweak scale, right?
I think it's annihilating into pi.
Right. But this cross section is set by that scale.
But it's now strongly coupled.
Still not or 8 orders of magnitude.
Yeah,
this is all 1 GeV. You are only
4 orders of magnitude seems reasonable.
Right.
8 is
right.
Okay,
I mean, there were statements that the gluino gets suppressed by 8 orders of magnitude, but that includes the processes with, like, well, first of all, it's questionable. Second, it includes processes with a regular QCD at the pion energy, regular pion energy scales, with coalescence of these things. Now I ask this question: do these dark matter candidates, do they have our QCD strong interaction or not?
No.
Then 10⁻⁸ seems like an underestimate for the abundance. No?
Mm-hmm. Is there some long range effect because of the pion?
We are all experts in dark matter.
But where did you get this number from?
Okay, so this, I should really say, maybe I shouldn't even have put this number. This is really a very super rough estimate. And we didn't think about this in detail. This is like maybe a future project to look at this, because we can get probably a very tiny relic density, but we get relatively large direct detection cross sections, which is kind of interesting.
Where it can come from, possibly, right, is from very inefficient hydronization into this baryons, right? Because if you imagine that everything is melted, you have quarks and diquarks, they annihilate maybe to the level of 10⁻⁴, right? But if in the subsequent hydronization, most of it goes into this pi HCs, right, and it decays, then, and only a fraction gets hydronized into baryons. That's probably where you got extra for it.
Yeah, I think this number was just really an NDA estimate of the cross section or something. So there's really not much going into it. It's just more an idea for the future. Okay, and that's all. So we constructed a model with lots of relatively low-lying confining new resonances. It's at the moment, I think, very hard to see at LHC, and also precision electric precision tests. There's some things maybe still to check, but we can generate a large Tevatron forward backward asymmetry, which was our original motivation for this model. Thank you.
Question. I can't help it, but this is probably the least of your concerns, your problems. But I think you have a lambda of below 10 TeV or so. Because your scalar couples to both of them is like huge, your powers. No?
Okay. I didn't think of this.
You have loop corrections to your
For the hypercolor in, coupling, you mean?
Well, we'll be
the hypercolor
is due to the S, you say.
And the S you can't, the S quart
oh,
you run
the,
because
the S quart.
Anyways, sorry. More phonologically, can I ask you a top decay to up and pion?
Into top decay into up and a kaon, yes.
Or one of your light states.
I think it's kinematically not allowed, because the kaon is 140 and the pion one is 60, so it's about 200.
No, why can't the top decay into a light quark and one of your sort of.
Ah, sorry. Sure, yeah, this is allowed, yeah.
And it's not
the
kaon
in the up. But
maybe
isn't
not.
This.
I mean, just because the Okawas are huge.
I mean, this is basically this diagram?
Yeah.
Well,
the
okay.
Star UK.
Okay, here's the K decaying into top up, the top decaying into
KU.
I don't know, I guess it's suppressed, so like, so you would say like...
No,
this,
forget about everything
yeah,
in
okay.
this diagram except
okay.
for that little vertex on the right bottom, T.
So you produce somehow the top and then it decays in, I don't know, I think it's a very suppressed branching ratio, I would guess. It's probably will decay into the B and W. But okay,
right.
I don't know. I didn't think about this. I don't know.
Any further questions?
About the HC measurement of discharge symmetry, do you know the prospect for the HC in terms of the error? Because you showed the measurement in 7 and 8 dB. I'm wondering with this sort of one error, basically.
And I don't know out of the memory.
Okay.
I guess probably because you get a larger gluon contribution, it will probably get less and less of an effect. And but I don't know any numbers. No.
Okay, there are no more questions. Thank you again.